very much, Danny. So we now, after such a thought-provoking presentation, we've now nearly got half an hour for questions. I've certainly got a few. I guess you will have. Whoa, and there's an old pro who's got his hand up already. Sir?
You've just now been talking about the life of one person, particularly that we're aware of, is the southeast, where one's not mostly the same one, because the bubble is going to a different state. When the bubble does burst there, how much impact do you think that would have on the rest of the country?
Yes.
Not the very richest, but the very richest, but some people in London will find themselves in negative vacancy. The question is whether people in the rest of the country who are in property at all, and not at bubble prices, in the same way, will similarly be affected.
Okay, so the question is, when the London bubble bursts, how will that affect people who aren't in London, the South East?
Okay. The majority of the feeling is that it will have a terrible effect across the whole country. My best evidence for this is what Labour did in their last year of office. Labour halved the regional budget, the money going to the North East and to Wales and so on. They took half of it, cut it, and they put half of that money into it was called something like the Mortgage Rescue Scheme for the southeast of England. Or it was for the whole country, but it ended up, all the money went into the southeast. So Labour, under Gordon Brown, with Dan Corey as the head of economics number 11, moved all this money to try to protect the southeast housing market, because their theory was the entire economy depends on the southeast housing market. It's 61% of our wealth is held in housing. We don't save in other forms very well. People think the houses are going to be their pensions. So there is a worry of a general meltdown of confidence. You could get a sterling crisis, you could get a run on the pound, you could then see interest rates having to rise up and up and up. And that is the fear. So it's not just George Osborne trying to keep up votes in the South East while there is help to buy. It is the great unknown of what would happen. Danny Blanchflower, who was on the Monetary Policy Committee at least 3 years ago, said we're 30% overvalued, and that's before the prices began going up again. I think what you need to have in place, and we already have some of these policies, is policies that allow people to stay in their home when they can no longer pay the mortgage, but can become tenants. And Northern Ireland hasn't done the legislation, but Scotland, Wales and England have, and it's already being used. So people, particularly families with kids, are, when they can no longer pay the mortgage, the ownership of the house is transferred from the bank to a housing association and they stay in the home. I think those are the kind of things you need to be ready to roll out in the event, because you have no idea how big a big correction could be, what the effect would be of a correction. But certainly it would rattle all the way up here. But in a way, kind of, not necessarily up here in the lakes, but certainly on the coast. And so you've already kind of got this with house prices and what's happened in the less desirable parts of the north. You've watched prices go to 30%, 40% below their peak already. But because it's in areas where people with the least voice live, you don't hear much about it.
Okay, lady right to the edge there with the white top on.
So I'm a young renter in London, and I've moved 9 times in 5 years, and I've shared rooms with 2 other girls, and I've been illegally evicted. And I just can't, the idea of owning feels so far away from me. And recently me and my friends have started talking about housing co-ops as a solution. And I was wondering what role you thought that could play, kind of on a bigger scale. Like, could the government better publicise it as an option, or somehow incentivise it, like build a ring fence for that, or is it not going to play a big role?
It should certainly be part of the solution.
Okay, the question is, housing co-ops, are they part of the solution?
Yeah. And having moved 9 times as a renter in 5 years in London,
yeah,
which is how we get the 1 year on average moving, because some people like you have to be moved on more. My favourite, this is a long time ago, my favourite eviction that I had, a landlord was trying to get us out in Newcastle, wouldn't go, or said he wanted to stay for 2 months, came home one day and found he'd taken the roof off. He just said it was unsafe. Yeah, and that was, I mean, it's not quite as bad as that. But you can probably see that if you do read the book, that isn't in the book, but that did colour my opinion of landlords. There's an organisation called Priced Out, and just Google Priced Out. Priced Out is angry young London professionals who, everything else is going for them in life, and often they're actually quite well paid, but they're in the same situation as you. And I think they're potentially a very powerful political force. Now, they want lots of things, but including co-ops, including the right to build. It's incredibly hard to build your own house, that's all I would say. But I think we should have increased rights for people to be able to do that. Co-ops are very hard to live in. I was having dinner with somebody, I don't know if she's in the audience today, who's managed to live in a kind of co-op in Islington for the last 30 years with 3 separate people, but it requires a remarkable degree of patience. That's all I'll say about that. But certainly, we need all kinds of things in imagination. But a co-op gets people to better use a dwelling. You know, co-op dwellers are never under-occupied, so I'd say they're great. But I would partly concentrate on the other side. Your problem is that if you take, say, Kensington and Chelsea, which is you never think of living in, the population in Kensington and Chelsea has been going down for the last 15 years. There are less people now living in that borough. Because there are less people living in that borough, more of the people who would be living in Kensington and Chelsea are now living out in Westminster or in Islington or in Camden. And that's partly why you're being pushed into being more and more crowded. So you need to, whatever you do will only be successful if we see the population in Kensington and Chelsea rise again to get people back in there. And the most inefficient thing in London is that. I was talking to a Conservative member of the House of Lords who said how upset he was to be driven by his chauffeur from the House of Lords past all these houses he cannot live in with no lights on at night. You know, and when you get to a point when Tory members of the House of Lords feel badly housed, you know, you sort of think, are we so absolutely incapable to work together to better house ourselves?
Okay, lady on the second row. Could you comment on the supposed wave of immigration?
Yeah, well spotted. I do say a bit in the book. There is one very good reason to build, and that would be immigration. So if we continue to have relatively high rates of net immigration, and it's going at between 100 and 200,000 a year, and it hasn't gone down to tens of thousands, the only way we could cope with continual immigration is to build. The fascinating thing for me is that the pro-building argument, which is massive, all political parties support building 200,000, 300,000 homes a year, shelter goes free. Nobody who says we need to build mentions immigration at all. But the reason why you would have to build that number of houses is if we continue to have high rates of net immigration. And it's incredibly emotive. Immigration was the key, the most salient issue at the 2001 election, the 2005 election. It was only knocked off the top issue for voters in Britain at 210 because of the biggest economic disaster since 1929. And that only got immigration to be number 2. I mean, it's quite incredible how important in the minds of a large number of voters immigration is. My take on it is that you know you're doing well if you're living somewhere where people are trying to get into. The worst places to live, such as California in the 1960s, or the Welsh Valleys 100 years ago, which were the highest immigration centres in the world. The worst places to live in Britain are parts of the South Yorkshire coalfield or Blaenau Gwent, all these places which have absolutely no immigration. And interestingly, UKIP are about to hold their conference in Doncaster, which is one of the lowest immigration areas of Britain, but where they get some of the highest support. I can talk to you more about that. But these things are... I won't go on, because hopefully you'll probably ask more questions about immigration. I personally don't think the current housing issue is caused by immigration. We still have enough. However, if immigration were to continue at these rates, then we are going to have to build a lot more or try to stop it. And when you try and stop immigration, all that tends to happen, there's some evidence you actually get more. So the US has more Mexicans than it would otherwise have. But you tend to get people from other places than the places that they would have come from. You get more people from poorer areas. I'll stop there, but just ask again if you want to know more or attack me on my liberal views on immigration.
Okay, we're getting down to the last 15 minutes. We've had three questions and there's tons of people, so we'll try and keep it low. Gentleman at the back there. Yes, you, sir.
Thank you. Part of the question I was going to ask, but I think it's worthy of a little bit more discussion, the dismissal of building new or increasing the houses.
Yeah.
But you've spoken a little bit, and I don't disagree with the fact that the proportion of new build any one year we can name related to the existing housing stock is absolutely minuscule, and therefore that's why I think you can dismiss it in broad terms. But the question is, do you therefore dismiss the lack of new build housing over the last period of time in the political spectrum as being irrelevant to the housing crisis?
Okay. Do you think that the low level of new build is entirely irrelevant to the current crisis?
We do need new build because houses only last for 150 or 200 years, so you have to replace them. We actually have had a building boom. The only way you can see, not of new houses, you can see it by looking at the census. The biggest building boom was between 2001 and 2011, and it was bedrooms over the garage, into the attic. We've had this huge increase in rooms in this country because when transactions halved, or before they halved, people were expanding families and made their houses bigger. And this is not just in London, they build downwards. So the biggest increase in rooms has been with the lowest building of new homes. And of course, those two things are related. The problem with this is that you build your extra rooms when your children are heading towards the teenage years. You know, nobody builds over the garage when they don't need to. And then they fly off. So we have more and more people who've actually got more bedrooms. But we have actually had a building boom that hasn't been noticed because it's been extensions. But we do need more building. I mean, to come back to immigration, we have 1% of the world's adults. We only have 0.5% of the world's children. I think we are likely to be a high immigration country for 20 or 30 years to come, which will require London to double up in height if it's going to carry on being the 25th largest city in the world. We are going to need building. And certainly in Oxford now, house prices are 11 times average wages. Oxford University is going to cease to function. Lecturers cannot afford to live there, let alone students, let alone the people serving the lecturers at high table, which could be improved somewhat.
Okay, I'm going to ask people to keep their questions short. Gentleman there, who come to you next.
Two things happened in the Thatcher era which I'd be interested to hear your views on, and that was the right to buy and the council houses going into housing associations.
What do you think of right to buy and council houses going to housing associations
from Thatcher? The other thing she did was create a housing benefit system, which we now have. I was in favour of right to buy. I would just like a right to sell to balance it. And the right to sell would, and that's part of people staying in their homes where they can't pay the mortgage, that would get rid of the stigma of a council estate. But I like right to buy. I think you should own your home when you want to, at a time when you want to do the DIY and the other things. But it shouldn't be about making money. Home ownership should be you want to look after the gutters yourself and you don't want to look after the gutters, you should have a landlord. The housing associations was a move towards these kind of more paternalistic non-profit making bodies, and the idea that councils couldn't do it. The problem with that is housing associations have become more and more almost privatised and profit making. So they make a lot of profit but disguise it as not being profit, and that isn't helpful.
Okay, lady on the front row.
When we got married in 1970 on a teacher's salary, my salary couldn't be taken into account. Three times my husband's was, and we could buy a house within 50 miles of London, commuting distance from London. When that ceased, that made life increasingly difficult, and it's still knocking on that childcare now, yeah. I'm a granny having to take care of my grandchildren because my daughters all have to go out to work, whether they like it or not. Now, I'm not saying it should not be the woman's, you know, salary, but this caused a huge change in social living altogether. And I couldn't even live on the furthest part of the West Coast on three times a teacher's salary now.
So the question is about the changing relationship between salary and house prices.
Eleven times
the average income, and having to use two people's salaries, and I mean it's really rank up and up. I mean part of why they crashed in September '89 was that the government were removing what's called double mortgage interest tax relief then. So couples who were using both their salaries to buy a house desperately tried to buy before September '89 to get this tiny benefit. And then bought a house that crashed in value. We've just got to a stupid situation. It is stupid. It's not as if we're paying more for the housing because the quality is that much higher. I'll try and keep out of saying anecdotes about myself. We've just bought a house. The house was built in 1920 by a gardener in Oxford who built it himself. Almost nothing has been done to this house since 1920, so it's very damp, and we've got to do a lot to be able to live in it. But the house now costs an absolute fortune compared to what it cost when it was brand new and in a better state in 1920. But you feel grateful the fact you can actually live and don't have to do a 1.5, 2 or 3 hour commute. It's a complete mess. At the same time, I'm currently renting in North Oxford, where more and more property is empty, is used by the Russians and Chinese moving in now to North Oxford. It's the highest rate of second homes in Oxford, is the most expensive area. And the school catchment area for the poshest comprehensive is getting bigger and bigger because there are no kids in the, you know. I'd honestly think, the interesting thing about housing is it's our everyday experience of what is stupid about what we're doing. Whereas most of us don't have to go to food banks, you know, most of us are not actually facing unemployment, some of us will be. Hardly anybody here has got the £9,000 student loan, so it's not affecting us yet. But the housing thing does. Well, if it's not us, it's our relatives, so we should use housing. It's the largest part of the cost of living crisis, much more than the fuel. We need to use housing to galvanise some kind of idea that this should be sorted out better. Partly because a lot of it doesn't require money to sort out. A lot of it is about how do we fit better into the existing stock?
Okay, so lady here.
Those battery clearing spaces seminar you were there, it's a few years ago. And someone talking about how big corporate companies and that were buying in the hundreds, thousands on houses on the continent.
Yes.
And they've starting to have here. Is that still on?
Are big corporate companies still buying up the housing stock?
Yeah.
You begin to. Even the Prudential has bought 500 houses to become a landlord. Many houses at the top are bought supposedly through a corporation to avoid tax, so people form their own company. Or, to avoid the latest thing, a company owns a house in London, and if you want to buy the house, you buy the company and you get the house. You don't pay the stamp duty. So part of the corporate ownership is disguised residential ownership. But the other part is we have the lowest property taxes in almost anywhere in the rich world. I mean, you're only paying, you know, the Sultan of Brunei doesn't pay any more than somebody else. So this is currently seen as one of the safest places to put your money if you are a corporation with spare cash or individuals with spare cash. And that is helping to exacerbate the housing problem in the southeast, and probably up here. You know, I bet there'll be people buying holiday homes or second homes that are actually no longer a holiday home and no longer a second home. They're not actually going to them. It's a safe place to park your money. And it would be interesting to know whether there's been, you know, given that we now know it's happening outside of London, after North Oxford, where's it next? And you think, nice stone cottage in the lakes. You know, you don't actually need to go there at all.
Okay, lady just there with the glasses. Yes, you.
approved the right to buy, but you didn't explore the effect of that. Many people who bought to buy then sold on to landlords.
Yes.
And also, nothing more was built to replace the people who would have wanted to rent council houses. Have you not looked into that? It seems to me, I mean, right to buy had its advantages, but it was abused. We've seen it abused for student housing. Yeah. Complete council states almost, which have been now bought by landlords.
Yeah.
And furthermore, am I right in thinking that help to buy has actually gone also to buy to let landlords?
Yes.
I thought it wasn't going to, but I think it did.
Yes. Okay, you are right.
Well, just there's a couple of questions in there, but the right to buy leading to private landlords taking the stock ultimately.
I've got a series of examples in the book, including, I think it's Ian Gower's son, who's managed to buy a huge number of ex-council houses, and he was involved in the legislation. So it certainly has been abused. But the actual initial right to buy was the biggest ever transfer of money to the poorest tenth we'd ever had in Britain. The wealth of the poorest tenth went from 3% to 4% because of discounts.
But if that money had gone into building new houses,
it could have done.
Yeah.
Oh, and the second thing on help to buy can be used by landlords. You pretend you're buying it for yourself. And then you decide 6 months later that you actually want to let it out. So they've got no way of stopping landlords doing it. I'll give you my view about council houses and council estates, because this is what I got in trouble with The Guardian on their review of this book. And I do worry a bit, because The Telegraph gave me 5 stars, the FT liked it, The Guardian weren't sure. The Times didn't like it, okay? Sunday Times hated it, so that's good. So credibility. I think council houses were a brilliant solution of the last century, and council estates were a brilliant solution of the last century. I worry that a lot of people on the left, like me, look at what worked in the 60s and 70s and say, why can't we have that again? The same with comprehensive schools, which I went to. Why can't we have that again, a bog standard comp, which was great for me in the 70s and the 80s. And what we don't do on the left is say, let's pretend we're sitting there in the 50s, 60s and 70s again. And supposing people then had gone back and said, let's do what they did in the 1920s and 30s. Let's have schools with gold, silver and whatever children segregated. Or we'll do slum clearance and give you nice new back-to-backs. Right? But they didn't. They did something new and imaginative. So the modern-day equivalent of building council estates would be allowing co-ops and people to build themselves. It'll be something different. And I think what's really hard for people on the left to do is, because we were so equal in the 70s, because it was great, 1976 was the best year to be alive, and the slur that's been done on the 70s is terrible. It's a very bad time to be rich. Inflation meant you lost your money. Most people, it was a really good time. Full employment. You know, you could walk into any job. But just trying to recreate that is no good. We need new things and new ways of living, not least because our family structures have changed. People are not going to be sitting in little family units for 20 or 35 years, keeping the same job, able to pay a mortgage check every month for 25 years. That basic model of a mortgage relied on a form of full employment that's gone. Banks don't tell you this, because banks do extremely well out of people taking out mortgages that they're never going to be able to repay. But we need new forms of housing for a precariously employed population that at least give us security for where we go home and sleep at night.
I'm afraid that's it. So Danny will be signing books afterwards, so you can have a quick word with Danny when he's signing your book. And I guess for the word that keeps coming through there was imagination. And we've all got imaginations, haven't we? So let's just say thank you very much to Danny Dorling for such a stimulating and imagination-provoking hour.